How do kids learn science? Mostly in school, huh? Well, probably not. This hour, we'll look at informal science education. From museum trips to after-school programs, can kids learn science better by thinking outside the classroom? And some schools are working to keep undergraduate science majors in science. We'll find out how. Speaking of informal science education, the Discovery Channel's Mythbusters have taken on more than 700 myths. Like, how hard is it to find a needle in a haystack? It's pretty hard. The show's co-hosts are here. We'll bust some myths, like the one about why cell phones need to be turned off on airplanes. What myth would you like them to bust? Some answers and your questions after the break, so stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're going to be hearing President Obama talking about the need to help kids learn science in places other than the classroom.
I want us all to think about new and creative ways to engage young people in science and engineering, whether it's science festivals, robotic competitions, fairs that encourage young people to create and build and invent, to be makers of things, not just consumers of things.
And we keep hearing about how American students are falling behind the rest of the world when it comes to math and science. But new studies are showing that the places to teach science, places where kids will soak up science, are not in the classrooms, but museum trips, TV shows, after-school clubs, even radio shows about science. Has that been your experience, too? What do you think? How much of what you know about science comes from your experience outside of a classroom? Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can always go to our website at sciencefriday.com and also on our Facebook page. And you can tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI. Let me introduce my guests. Lynn Dierking is the C. Grant Professor in Free Choice Learning in the College of Science at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. She's also the Interim Associate Dean for Research at the College of Education at Oregon State University. She's also an advisor to Science Friday, and I want to thank her for being with us here today. Hi, Lynn.
Hi there, Ira. Nice. Great to be here.
Nice to have you. Susan Singer is a professor of natural sciences at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. She joins us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Ira.
And Linda Kakalis is an executive director of TechBridge. That's in Oakland, California. Thank you, Linda, for being with us today.
Hi, Ira. I'm looking forward to our discussion today.
Me too. And let me kick it off. Let me ask Lynn Dierking. You study informal science education. Tell us what that informal part means.
Well, it's about all the kinds of ways that we learn. And I would say we've been talking, I know in the information you've provided, talked a lot about children. But it's the way that our society supports people of all ages and walks of life in exploring and learning about science and technology and engineering and mathematics. So you mentioned many of the places, museums, science centers, radio programs, television. I was fascinated. Flora's piece is one of my favorite Science Friday pieces, and I was fascinated to hear about the search for the imperial woodpecker. We've got a couple of free choice science learners on our hands who were able to pursue their interests and hobbies around STEM.
Do your studies show that more people are learning science outside of the classroom in these informal places?
I wouldn't say more people, but I do think, and I wouldn't necessarily say that these are better places, but I think that what these opportunities do for children and adults is they help them understand at a deeper level some of the things that they have learned in school, mm-hmm. or they may get them excited about something that then they want to pursue in more depth in school. But there's definitely evidence in my work and the work of other people doing research on this area that these experiences can be exceedingly powerful. They're very memorable. And actually, they connect often to other experiences mm-hmm. that children and adults have in their lives, both in school and out of school.
Linda Kakalis, you are director of a program called TechBridge. Tell us about that, please.
TechBridge is a nonprofit that's based here in Oakland, California, and we turn girls on to science and engineering through enrichment programs outside of school. The heart of TechBridge are after-school and summer programs where we have a chance to give girls time to tinker and build things and take things apart and discover their inner engineer or computer programmer.
We don't always think of girls as doing this.
That's right, and the girls don't either until they have a chance to be in TechBridge. And by being in the company of girls, they discover that they really do love science and technology when they get to work on projects that appeal to their interests.
Mm-hmm. And we actually have one of the students online, Nori Duban, is a 10th grader in Oakland Unity High School, and she's with us. Hi there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi. Are you eager to go to these after-school projects?
Can you repeat that?
Do you like working on these projects, taking things apart and learning how they work?
Yes, I love it. I love getting my hands, in there and just, doing something from scratch. And if I mess up, trying to figure out what I did wrong and just, I love TechBridge.
Yeah, and what got you interested in it? Did you always have that interest, or did it have to bring someone like your teacher, like Linda, have to bring it out of you?
Well, I have always been interested in science and, learning about how stuff works and why it works like that and just that theory. But my teacher actually came and talked, because I didn't know what TechBridge was really about until my biology teacher came and talked to us, and he was talking about this program that was really a hands-on program where girls got to build stuff and just get out there into the world of engineering and just do what they have to do and learn about science, which you don't get to see a lot of girls engineering.
No, you don't. Do you find that TechBridge helps you in your schoolwork at all?
Yes, I can really relate to what I'm learning in TechBridge to other stuff that I'm learning in my school. Like last year, I used to be in biology class, and I remember that a biology major came in, and she was talking to us about science, biology, and microscopes, and I could follow along with her because I was just learning about that in my biology class, and then she taught us how to do a microscope out of, materials that were very tiny, and then, so that was really cool. I was really excited to learn how to do something that was also related to my schoolwork.
And are you going to follow up and major in science in college, you think?
I am definitely going to major in science once I go to college. I love science. I think it's a great, it's just a concept where you can learn how to do something yourself and get to answer questions that you have and get to know why that happened. And I just love science.
Well, good luck to you, Nori, and thank you for taking time to be with us on the show.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Nori Duban is a 10th grader at the Oakland Unity High School in California. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about informal science education and how to get it and where it's happening. Let me ask Susan Singer, tell us what's happening once kids get to college. So now, she's going to start out, Nori, as a science major. What's going to happen to her? Is she going to drop out if she's like everybody else?
Oh, I hope not, but I don't have all cheery news today, Ira. I coach a Science Olympiad high school in Minnesota, and I want all of my students, just like Nori, that are excited about science to go on and have a terrific experience. It turns out that nationally, the United States actually ranks 27th in the world in terms of the proportion of our college students that graduate with degrees in science and engineering and math, and it's not just because we don't have enough students coming to college excited about science, we're losing them. In fact, nationally, about 40% of all students who come excited and say they're going to be science or engineering or math majors graduate within 5 years. The rest don't. And if we break it down demographically, it's a little more discouraging. Students from underrepresented groups graduate with one of those degrees in 5 years at a rate of about 20%. So we're losing folks. And we don't want anyone to have a bad experience. And beyond that, I think we really have to think about what the national implications are. Right now, in terms of the U.S. population, about 28% of the U.S. population are members of underrepresented groups. Yet in the workforce, only about 9% of the science and engineering workforce are members of underrepresented groups.
What is an underrepresented group?
In the statistics I've been giving you, they've been broken down in terms of Blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans, and also Asians, although Asian students tend to do better than white students overall in terms of retention.
Is there some way we teach engineering and other topics? I remember when I was in engineering school, it was almost like they were trying to weed us out. You know, instead of encouraging us to become engineers, like, okay, we're going to get the people who don't belong here out of here.
Whether that's the intent or not, that seems to be what's happening. And I would confess to being one of those engineering dropouts. I got hooked on genetics. I'm a biologist. But perhaps my experience wasn't unlike what you saw. We know so much about how to teach effectively and engage students. But for a whole plethora of reasons, that seems to not be happening right now in undergraduate education. And one of the most common reasons students report leaving science as a major is the type of teaching they experienced.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Lynn Deer King. She's C Grant Professor in Free Choice Learning at the College of Science at Oregon State University in Corvallis. Susan Singer is Professor of Natural Sciences at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. And Linda Kakalis is the Executive Director of TechBridge in Oakland, California. Before we go to the break, Linda, Lynn, have you heard anything here that you can respond to? You give us any ideas of how to teach these kids better?
Yeah, I think something that is really interesting in what Sarah was sharing is that some of the work that I'm doing, in fact, I know Linda because we've been tracking some of the young women who participated in TechBridge, you know, as many years ago as 10, 15 years. One of the things we're finding out is that the experiences that are provided in out-of-school settings can be extremely powerful and impactful for children and youth who are from underrepresented groups. And it's not clear exactly why that might be the case. Clearly, part of it is an opportunity to become very engaged and have the hands-on experience. I think Nori spoke to that very, very well. But there's also this sense of other people like me who are interested, and in the case of women specifically.
Okay, Lynn, hang on. We'll get to that point after the break, so I don't want to cut you off. We'll give you a full chance to answer that. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Well, the holidays are right around the corner, and if you're already trying to get your holiday gift list together, may I request that you keep Science Friday in your thoughts. It may be hard to believe, but the bulk of our funding comes from private donations like yours. This is what goes to create the radio show, our podcasts, websites, social media, phone apps. So please, give what you can, $5, $10, whatever works for you. We'll send you a tax-deductible receipt, and you can even make donations as a gift to someone else. Just visit our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the link to support us. And thanks. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about informal science education and its relationship to formal classroom learning with my guest, Lynn Deer King. She's at Oregon State University, Susan Singer at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, and Linda Kakalis, she's at TechBridge in Oakland, California. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. And when I rudely interrupted Lynn Deer King, she was telling us about her own experience.
Yeah, actually, I apologize. Actually, I realized I called Susan Sarah. I'm sorry, Susan.
No worries.
Just joining the spirit of me getting names wrong, so you fit right
in. Yeah, I just wanted to add that this community piece seems to be really important among young women, a place where they feel safe being smart and being able to do things that are not maybe typically the things that girls, particularly in their community, might engage in. And I think that that's a really important piece of this. And the research supports that seems to emerge. Mm. Also, knowing a scientist and knowing people that can give you advice. Many of the young women in the study that I've been involved in with my colleague Dale McCready at the Franklin Institute, those young women are the first people in their families to go to college. And so they don't have the background and history of knowing, you know, how do you apply for college and what's important? How do you visit a college and make a decision? Mm-hmm. So it really supports what Susan was saying about the importance of getting children and youth into college and then helping to support them while they're in college.
Linda Kakalis, we keep hearing from experts like those on this panel today that it's important to have a mentor for kids. Is that what TechBridge does? It gives you, as Lynn Dierking was saying, a role model, and as Susan has been saying, to a role model and a bridge to get you interested in college and to stay in college?
We find role models are really important. We do lots of fun hands-on activities, and the girls tell us that, you know, they really enjoy the experience. It's very different from the school day, but they see those sorts of projects as hobbies but not as career interests. So it really takes a role model who can help dispel the stereotypes that kids might have about who does science or engineering, and also help share their passion for what they do and show girls that science and engineering can help make the world a better place, which is a very great interest to the girls that we work with. Mm-hmm. And what we've also discovered is that a lot of people want to support kids and be role models but may not have the experience or the know-how for how to relate to kids or how to share their career. So it's really important that role models get support and training in advance. You know, we help them prepare for any classroom visit or field trip that they do with our girls and come up and share a personal story and help the girls relate to them, mm-hmm. Show that, you know, life is not all work, but they also have got, you know, hobbies and interests outside of work and family life that's important for kids to hear about. And I think especially for the girls that we work with who are from under-resourced communities, you know, being able to see the wide range of careers that are available in science and engineering are so important for helping the girls to see new possibilities and what they can do.
Susan Singer, if you had to put your finger on the, one of the main reasons that the college kids drop out of science and engineering majors as majors, what would you say that is?
Well, I think what happens is they're not feeling successful, and they feel like they're working very, very hard and beating their heads against a wall and not making progress. And I think what we can collectively do, in a way, is like the mentoring piece. If we have better professional development for the people that are teaching them, to help structure their learning in a way that they make progress and feel good about what they're learning.
So we need to teach teachers to be better teachers.
Absolutely, right. We've learned that in K-12, and we're really starting to understand that in higher ed, where typically someone gets a PhD and knows a lot about their research field, but they don't know about how people learn or what kind of instructional strategies are successful. And as a new faculty member, you're just tossed out there, and mm-hmm. people want to do their best and they're trying very hard, but they don't necessarily have the resources. And there are a lot of programs that are starting to emerge both during the graduate school experience and after that that are helping.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you may not see yourself as a teacher once you get in there. You're a scientist and a PhD.
And that's traditionally how we've prepared people. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and you don't have the training to do that. So that's like your secondary job, you view
right.
yourself as, not as your primary job of what you need to do is to teach these students.
Right, and most young faculty would like to keep their jobs and obtain tenure, and in many, many institutions, mm-hmm. research productivity is the currency of the realm.
Let's go to Laura in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hi, Laura. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hey, Well, I just wanted to say that I really think you have to have both programs going on. In my experience as a student, I like science. I had good science teachers, but I also had the opportunity for a lot of experiences in museum programs and science camps and even just going to museums that are some of the things that really stick with me. And I've also worked in both environmental education, and then I taught high school for 7 years. And it's a lot harder in the classroom environment to make it interesting and exciting, especially with situations like, you know, crowded classrooms, lack of supplies. And I think a lot of kids just never find out the interesting things about science if they don't get a chance for those hands-on programs and, like, experiences that really engage them personally and make them feel like they're discovering something. So I think you're definitely on the right track with this. The kids have got to have the opportunity for both. And I'm just starting a biology PhD program, but one of my long-term goals is to really help support those programs that get kids involved in the interesting, like, the exciting parts of science so they see what's going on with it.
Mm-hmm. Lynn Dierking, any reaction?
Yeah, I would absolutely say that I think something that we're beginning to understand and is starting to be a part of the conversation is how do we build bridges between what kids are doing in school with their out-of-school experiences, and then how do we build bridges within the educational system? Building on what Susan said a few minutes ago, I was just at a meeting in D.C., actually yesterday and the day before, talking about how we need to better understand how children and youth move through both their in-school time and their out-of-school time, and how they connect that to further education, further hobbies and pursuits. And so this is a conversation that's happening at the national level, talking about the fact that we can't just focus in on improving classroom teachers' abilities. We need to think about the whole ecosystem of education and really support undergraduate, graduate education, technical education. Something that came up at this meeting were the number of youth that are dropping out, and to the point where in some communities they're not even talking about K-12 anymore. They're talking about K-8. Well, how do we reach children and youth who are disengaged and not even in the school system? So I think these notions of how we can connect and talk to one another in these different educational settings is really important.
All right, that's depressing to hear, K-8 versus K-12.
Indeed it is.
Wow, so people aren't even getting a high school education. Many more people are not getting a high school education. They're trying to reach them before they get to the eighth grade.
Yep, and once again, that relates to these statistics that Susan was sharing. I mean, 50% of the children in school don't move on. They may get a high school diploma, but they don't move on into the system. And then, of course, the ones that do get there, the sobering statistics Susan was sharing about how many of them don't complete their degrees is very very sobering.
So, Susan, last comment. It sounds like things are getting worse instead of getting better.
Well, I think the situation is serious, but I tend to be more optimistic than that. I think there's a growing awareness of this, and I think there's a collective will at all levels of education and an evidence base that's out there about what we can do. And mm-hmm. I think we're collectively going to find a way to do this.
Mm-hmm. With the resources we have?
Well, that's the sticking point, Ira.
The details.
We certainly have to rethink some things.
All right. Well, we'll save that for another time, because that's a whole other discussion. Thank you for being with us today. Susan Singer, Professor of Natural Sciences at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. Lynn Dierking, she's the C-Grant Professor in Free Choice Learning in the College of Science at Oregon State University in Corvallis. And Linda Kakalis is the Executive Director of TechBridge in Oakland, California. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Up next, blowing things up for science.
It's that familiar Mythbusters waiting game. That sewer's getting pretty full of methane.
Small scale proved that the perfect stoichiometric ratio sent manholes flying. However, will the full scale equivalent, 100 cubic feet of methane, prove just as effective?
Shall we do it?
I think it's time.
All right, call it.
All right, real world sewer explosion, best case scenario, sparking in 3, 2, 1.
Wow! Look at that!
That had to be 100 feet.
That was insane!
There they are. They are the Mythbusters. If you watch the Discovery Channel, you know those two voices, the two guys who investigate. Well, almost any myth you can think of. They get lots of ingenuity, duct tape, and the ever-present occasional explosion. They and their team have looked at everything from whether astronauts really landed on the moon to whether you can actually knock someone's socks off. In that episode that we just heard, that you heard a bit of, they were trying to prove whether or not methane gas can blow the cover off a manhole. And as you heard, the answer is yes. As I say, you may have guessed from that big boom, the explosion that had. And the Mythbusters are here with us for the rest of the hour. You can talk about their show and how they bring science to TV in unlikely ways. Jamie Heineman and Adam Savage are co-hosts of Discovery Channel's Mythbusters show. They're joining us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
Good to have you with us today.
Delighted to be here.
How many myths have you think you've busted by now?
I think we're breathing down the neck of 1,000. We've done almost 200 hours of Mythbusters over the last decade.
Wow. Are either one of you trained as scientists?
Jamie's got a degree in Russian studies, and I have a high school diploma, so no.
Jamie, your wife is totally unqualified. Your wife is a science teacher, though, right?
She is. Yeah, she has a real degree in science. And so, you know, she's very critical of what we do, needless to say.
She watches it very closely. We're talking this hour about informal science education. And do you guys view yourselves as informal science teachers?
We never set out to be. But it seems to be that this is a role we are fulfilling. I actually just got a lovely card from a little girl who happened to come by our shop a few months ago, and I happened to be on my way out to lunch, and I took a picture with her and her family. And she said that Mythbusters is legendary among her homeschooled friends. She's homeschooled and says that it provides the foundation for all of the science they learn in homeschooling. And it's a little shocking because, honestly, we never set out to do that. But it's a role we take seriously.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Adam Savage and Jamie Heineman of the Mythbusters. And you know, one of the interesting things that I show that you don't really see, but it soaks in, is that to do science, you have to collect data. Right? You have to be able to not just say something's going to happen. You have to create an experiment and then collect the data on it.
And absolutely.
Yeah.
This actually came to a head very, very early on when we were just sort of finding the shape of the show. We were doing Will a Penny Drop from the Empire State Building Kill You When It Hits the Ground? And we had some complex math that had been done by a NASA scientist as a hobby, where he figured out the terminal velocity of a penny both on its edge and on its face. And we had included a little sequence where Jamie and I talked through the math, but we were flying back from a location, and I realized that I didn't think that was enough. Then I thought I could actually build a wind tunnel with two different speeds. And I was able to go back to the shop and make this. And actually, once I put the penny in this wind tunnel with both the high terminal velocity and low terminal velocity, the penny tumbled up and down inside the tube. And for me, that was the first point at which I started to really engage with, it's always about showing, not telling. We want to show what's going on. We want the audience to have the same intuitive grasp of the conclusion as we hopefully end up with.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, without collecting the data, basically what we do on the show would be not unlike what, say, a teenage boy would do if you handed him some firecrackers and matches. I mean, you know, he'd run around and blow a bunch of different things up, but he probably wouldn't write down the results, and he wouldn't do it methodically, or at least as methodically as we do. And oddly enough, that's part of the appeal of the show, because it shows that this kind of stuff is actually fun. I mean, generally, science class isn't looked at as something where one runs around and blowing things up. But, you know, a lot of the different things that we approach, we're approaching the same way. We try things out. We get playful with them. We experiment sometimes, you know, with a great deal of mischief in mind. But we're always actually fairly methodical about it.
Mm. And one of the attractions about learning and teaching is that sometimes you may think you know the answer, but until you go out and do the experiment, you really don't. It may be just the opposite of what you think.
Absolutely. That happens. People, it's one of the most common questions we get. How often are you guys surprised by the results? And the answer is every freaking day. We just finished a few weeks ago filming a whole episode about the Lethal Weapon 2 toilet explosion, where Danny Glover is stuck on a toilet with a bomb underneath it, and he and Mel leap into a bathtub, cover themselves with a bomb blanket. And we, like we do on the show, set out to replicate each portion of the myth and break it down and then put it all together at the end. And the results absolutely gobsmacked us. We were unprepared for where they went. It was an amazing episode. And that's one of the best parts about it, is having an intuition, chasing it down, and realizing that you're wrong.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. We're with Jamie Heineman and Adam Savage, co-hosts of the Discovery Channel's Mythbusters show. And you got a question, you have a myth you want them to tackle? If it isn't on, they haven't already tackled it in 1,000 myths, give us a suggestion. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. I have my own favorite myth that maybe will get busted. So we'll talk about it when we get back. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Do you disagree with something our guest said? Maybe something even I said. Or maybe you've got a suggestion for a future show. Well, now you can leave us a voicemail on the telephone. Here's that number, 724-374-3063. That's 724-374-3063. And we might just play it during a future show. But there's only one rule. You've got to keep it short. Under 60 seconds. The clock is ticking. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday, talking with the Mythbusters, Adam Savage and Jamie Heineman. Jamie's the one with the mustache. You know, people wonder how to keep them apart on the radio. He's on the left side, on the right side. Our number, 1-800-989-8255 is our number. You guys are going on tour, I understand.
Is that right? We are.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll be all over the United States, and we've got a it's funny because when we go out in public, we're often asked to blow things up and so on, but we can't really do that because, well, you know, shrapnel and things like that. And so we've done our best to recreate some of the kinds of things that we do on the show without shrapnel.
And well, I mean, we also get asked a lot to, you know, go do some appearance and bust a myth. And we point out that that would be a demonstration. And truly what we do on the show is an experimentation. So we've also tried to weave that in, and we plan to actually do some experiments on the audience itself. There's a ton of audience participation built into this show. We've been writing it for the last few weeks, and we are super, super excited about it. I should point out that the tickets can be bought at MythbustersTour.com, and they went on sale today.
11-11-11. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's take a few more calls here. Hi, Bonnie in Fairfax, Virginia. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
So I just have to say thanks to the Mythbusters there, because they give me so many lessons for my science classes. I've taught high school earth science, and this last 2 years I've been teaching middle school 7th and 8th grade science classes. And guys, you guys just give me so much material for class. It's uncanny, because I can be teaching about Newton's laws or whatever, and I can pull up a clip of your show and demonstrate, just looking at the show, you know, some of the applications of Newton's laws. And then the kids and I can talk about, you know, what are some other ways that we could have tested that myth, or how are the laws being applied in that particular episode, or who knows? I can't remember all of the different times I've used it.
No, good for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you.
You're welcome.
A fabulous, fabulous show, and my family watches it, including my six-year-old.
There you go. Thank you, Bonnie. And that's really, you love to hear those calls, don't you? People who
Totally, but keep the six-year-old away from matches.
And exploding things.
Yes.
I'm wondering how these teachers can do this stuff without exploding the stuff up in their classrooms.
Jamie and I have spoken a few times at both the California and National Science Teachers Association, and while there are definitely people who know deeply how much we screw things up, mm-hmm. The level of appreciation and affection we get from science teachers is humbling. And they actually even say that specifically when we mess things up, it gives them even more fodder for Thursday right. mornings in class.
Yeah, if only to point out what we did wrong, which we're perfectly okay with. We revisit a lot of the experiments we do, and we actually it's very, I think, very powerful to point out that we like it when we do things wrong, because that means that we make note of it and we learn about it. If you don't fail at something, if you don't screw something up, you're just going through the motions. Yeah. And so in our case, whenever we screw things up, and this is something that's important to get across to students as well. It's not, science isn't about going in and just following the numbers. If you screw things up, that's good. Pay attention to it, and maybe you won't do that next time.
Yeah, we have scientists all the time saying that the road to success is littered with failures, of all of them, eliminating what doesn't work. 1-800-989-8255. I used to do a show called Newton's Apple on PBS.
I remember that show.
25 years ago, where we used to do demonstrations all the time. Thank you for remembering that. And I remember there was a huge staff behind me that no one ever saw. And I can imagine there must be a bunch of staff people behind you helping you out, thinking how to make the experiments and putting them together.
The figuring out of the experiments is Jamie and I. Mm-hmm. We have a fantastic crew here in San Francisco. It's about 25 people strong. In the 10 years we've been doing the show, many of our crew have been with us for the better part of a decade. So at this point, it's like a big family.
Yeah,
we've got a couple of engineers on staff, primarily the brain power that comes out in the show is through our producers and us interacting, mm-hmm. Along with the what we call our researchers or APs that do all the digging when we find something and we need, if there's something we don't know, we need to find out more about it, or we need materials or additional setups on location, then the APs swing into action and they kind of push it all through. But
they get us the permits that you're not supposed to be able to get.
Yeah.
Right. I get that. One of the tweets, a few people are tweeting in and asking, how many cameras do you break or blow up during any one of your episodes?
In our camera room, we actually have a cabinet for all of the burnt, broken, waterlogged, blown-up cameras. We did have one camera, which lasted for several years. It was like the undead cam, and we called it Crunchy Cam. While we were filming Can You Ignite Gasoline from that a Car is Spilling, we set fire to a camera, and this camera actually filmed itself on fire. And so we got it replaced. But it still worked, so it became our sacrificial lamb. And whenever there was like a ground zero, we'd put that camera there, and it kept on surviving and kept on surviving for about 3 years. It was the camera that wouldn't die.
I have one of my myths, and I'll talk a little bit about it later, that you guys have busted, was about using cell phones on airplanes and affecting the navigation system, was it? And you debunked that myth? Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, Cary Grant and Torrey tackled that, and it was that was actually one of the most difficult ones the researchers and APs ever had to permit. The FAA has a guideline that bans all use of cell phones on aircraft in the United States, and it's not legally binding, but the airlines don't go against it, and we couldn't get a special dispensation to do it. We had to do it as a ground test. So Cary Grant and Torrey found no correlation between the use of electronics and interruption with the avionics of the plane. That's not to say that it's not possible. There's been studies that have shown some links, have studies that have shown no links. There's no smoking gun. But honestly, as the more I think about it, the less I care, because I just don't want the guy next to me on the plane talking on his phone.
But you at least like to know if there are any real data showing any length, you know. And if it were really dangerous, I'll talk about this later. But it's just, I would just like to see the studies, you know.
Well there is a...
Well, so Boeing actually did this. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jamie.
There is a side note that one can make about that, which I don't believe we've actually tested. We probably will at some point. When bomb techs or blasting people that are doing blasting are in the zone where they're actually about to set something off, it's a radio silence area. It is possible for radio waves to create a spark by accident somehow. And so they often use, in fact, the standard for them to actually set off high explosives for mining and so on is something called non-L, which is it's not an electrical wire like you would expect from the box with the plunger in it that shows up in movies. It's actually a plastic tube with a chemical in it that requires a small detonation to light that chemical off, which zips down this tube to the other end and sets off the blasting cap there. So this is a real issue as far as radio waves are concerned. Obviously, as far as cell phones, you know, the amount of power that they're putting out is so small that it really is questionable that it would cause anything like that.
Go ahead. Yeah, I want to hear about that. No, go ahead. Talk about the Boeing.
Boeing did one of my favorite studies in conjunction with a magazine where any time a pilot felt like they'd seen an anomaly that they could trace to someone having turned on a device on a plane, they actually worked very diligently to buy as many of those like someone would turn on their phone and they might see something in the avionics. They'd rush right back there and offer the money for the phone, and then they would take it back to their labs and test it against their avionics. And throughout this extensive set of tests, they weren't able to find any correlation between the operation of the devices and the interruption with any of the functions of the avionics.
Yeah. And now we have you're allowed to use Wi-Fi on the airplane.
Right, exactly. And my Wi-Fi transmitter is a pretty powerful antenna.
Yeah, so we're going to actually ask for a shout-out at the end of the program. People to send us any information they may have. We'll be happy to pass it on to you. And
absolutely.
Yeah, you know, maybe I can get to come on your show and present some sort of...
You're welcome anytime.
Anytime.
Thank you. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Tom in Connecticut. Hi, Tom.
Hey there.
Hi there.
I am a fan. I'm 67, and I still love your show, and I was, as a teenager, blowing up stuff with firecrackers. But anyhow, there is urban myth and on the Internet, and my wife says, look at that. You can't do that. Anyhow, it's the cell phone when you're filling up the car. Does it ignite anything, or is it just bogus?
We found that it's bogus, but it's one of those interesting things that points out the value of experimentation, because when we were we staked out a gas station and watched what people were doing. I mean, of course, first we tried to just simply cause sparks and set fires with cell phones. We were unable to do so. But then we staked out this gas station and watched what people were doing.
Which is a horrifying exercise if you ever do it. Yeah. How cavalierly people deal with gasoline.
People with a cigarette in one hand and a cell phone in the other while they're filling gas. But what we saw happen was a lot of people were getting in and out of their cars. And while they were filling up. And so we did some tests, and we found that it is possible, and a lot of people know that it's possible to have a static spark generated by the upholstery in their car or by, you know, from the car itself. Sometimes you get out of the car and you get sparked. And so they might have thought that it was their cell phone that set off a fire, but it not necessarily was. It could have been that static spark. And that's you only see that from experimenting and trying things out.
Yeah. Well, and people don't realize that the resistance of air is about 10,000 volts per centimeter. So if you static spark a half-inch spark off your fingertip, that's 5,000 volts. And we showed on the show that was plenty to ignite gasoline. And now in California, there's stickers on the gas pumps that say specifically, don't get in and out of your car while you're filling with gas because you can build up a static spark, and that could cause an explosion.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. talking with the Mythbusters, Jamie Heineman and Adam Savage. And what people don't realize about gasoline is that the fumes hug the ground, don't they? They can just travel along the ground without having to see the liquid at all. And you guys showed that. You showed that in one of your Mythbuster experiments.
Havoc. I think
it's very scary stuff. I've had it burning on my skin. We did one myth where we were throwing Molotov cocktails. The invisible gases are the thing I have gained the most respect and fear of in the course of doing this show.
The other thing about gas fumes that we've tested and we've learned a lot about is that in the tank of gas in the car itself, it's only a very rare situation where the fumes would be flammable. Outside the car is a different story where there's plenty of air, but inside the tank, if there's any gasoline in there at all, it's going to be too rich and it won't support flame. So all of those movies where somebody shoots at the car the car blows up because the gas tank got hit is just not possible. It's only if the car was just like bone dry practically.
Right. And you were shooting it with an incendiary tracer round. Yeah.
Are there any things short of a nuclear explosion or any experiments, maybe I shouldn't even take that out of the equation, that are too...
We've been asked to do the Indiana Jones refrigerator survival of the nuclear explosion many, many times.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And so that short of that, is there anything you can't do that you would not try?
There's been one that's on the... Well, there's two. One that's been on the list forever is to do the Titanic. Will a sinking ship suck you down if you're standing on it? And we've several times tried to get cameras on the decks of ships that they've sunk for artificial reefs around the world, but have never been able to coordinate it. But we do have this one on the books about a tanker of liquid oxygen spilling on a roadway and turning the whole roadway into a bomb. And we did enough research into liquid oxygen to discover that it's like the scariest stuff on Earth. And it is super volatile, super unpredictable, and really spooky.
Yeah, what would be happening in that case was that the asphalt in the in the pavement would be saturated with the liquid oxygen, and it can become explosive. But we could test that on a small scale or whatever. But when it comes to doing it full sized, we realize that there are things that you have to worry about. Like, what if there was this is tons of liquid oxygen from one of these tanker trucks. And it's going to turn into, oxygen gas very quickly once it leaves the tank. Well, does that mean if you're, a half a mile away from a highway, are all the cars going to all of a sudden be like they're on nitrous oxide and go 100 miles an hour?
I love this image of a cloud of oxygen arriving on a roadway all the cars accelerating to double the speed.
We will wait to see you guys do that one. Thank you. Jamie Heineman, Adam Savage, co-hosts of the Discovery Channel's Mythbusters show. Good luck to you, and thanks for your work. Good luck.
Thanks, Ira.
Good luck
thanks
on your roadshow. That's one of the myths we tackled today by Mythbusters. It was about using cell phones on airplanes. I talked about it, and they concluded that the cell phones, the idea that cell phones interfere with airplane navigation was a myth. But we'd like to actually, because it's Science Friday, we want to take that one step further. We'd like to know what tests, experiments, data back up the need to turn off all the cell phones in your airplane. If cell phones are indeed a threat to the safe operation of an airplane, why don't they take them away from you like they do a weapon? They don't tell you to put your gun on safety. They take it away from you. Well, in addition, when airplanes fly at 10,000 feet or lower, not only are cell phones not allowed to operate, but all electronic devices are turned off. Everything, as they say. So what is it? What's the problem? We've gotten so many different explanations. We're not questioning that there are valid reasons for these things. We'd like to see the evidence. What studies have been done to show that cell phones, electronic devices, should not be used on airplanes? Not anecdotal evidence we hear about. We want to see the real evidence. And if you have it, send it to us at cellphone@sciencefriday.com. If you know where the evidence is, if you have the evidence, if you work for a federal agency, anybody, you have evidence about why none of these things should be. Cell phones, electronic devices should not be used. Are there real tests that show them? Do they exist? Send us an email, cellphone@sciencefriday.com, and go to our Facebook and leave us a little note and a trail to find it. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata and Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Plato. Thanks for listening.